This is Critical Edge. On this podcast, we learn how to think, not what to think. I'm Ollie. I'm here with my co-host, Lucas, and also with Dr. Mark Blythe. Mark, thank you for coming on today.
No, it's a pleasure so far. Let's see how we can fuck it up.
Okay. Well, we'll try our best. Mark, begin by telling our listeners about yourself in 20 words or less.
20 words or less. I'm a political economist. I teach at Brown University, United States. I'm originally from Dundee in Scotland, and I would have rather been a musician.
Okay, great. When's the last time you changed your mind in a significant way, Mark?
All the time. I'm married to a German, so I outsource my critical thinking a lot of the time. And what that means is I have to be culpable all the time. I have to be wrong all the time. I learned about 15 years ago, hanging out with Nassim Taleb, that the only real way you learn is by being wrong. So you have to be open to being wrong, or you don't learn. And what happened to me, and I'm quite serious when I say this, is that I just lost the ego regarding being right. So it's people get quite sort of offended by me sometimes when I go out and give talks, because I'll do this whole thing and I'll say, this is what I think is going on. And they'll be like, well, that can't be right and that can't be right. And I'm like, well, thank you. And they're like, well, what do you mean? It's like, well, I'm not going to defend it. If it's wrong, it's wrong. Right? So I'm quite open to being culpable in this. Now, do I have priors I want to defend and all the rest of it? Yeah, I'm human. I'm not sort of like, you know, I'm not an algo. But I think courageability is a quality, and we all need more of it.
Mm-hmm. Nassim Taleb is the guy who talked about having skin in the game for economists, right?
Yeah, and before that, the black swan, anti-fragile. I mean, he's one of the most interesting thinkers around.
Mm-hmm. Why don't you distill one of what you think is his most interesting idea, and we can start there.
All right, so he's got five books called Incerto, and I'll do the first three. First one's called Fooled by Randomness. It's an easy read, and it's basically about how we confuse luck with skill. So when you see somebody that did really well, there's a chance are they were just in the right place at the right time, and it has very little to do with the fact that the skill that they attribute to themselves. The second one is the black swan. The black swan basically says you might have great models and you might have great data, but things happen in this world that are not in the data. And no matter how you torture the data, you won't see it. And if you believe the world is just the stream of data, you're going to get totally screwed. And that was his explanation of the financial crisis before it happened. And then anti-fragile, if you are susceptible to black swans because the world's very complex, how do you live in a world you don't understand? What you do is you try and cover your downside for losses and be open to the upside. And for that, you need to be courageable. You need to be open to being wrong. Which brings us back to the first comment.
Yeah, it's your philosophy is not so dissimilar, right? Data is not everything. There's a human element to economics, especially. Could you break that down for us a little bit?
Sure. It's more than a little bit, actually. So in a sense, sort of the pretense of any science is that the system exists apart from how we see it. And for many things, that's true. For example, if you're studying galactic clusters, right? Your unit of analysis is a bit of the sky 200 million light years across, right? What I think about that has no reference point to my life unless I'm into astrology and it contains Sagittarius and I happen to believe all that stuff, right? But my intuitions about things happening, my actions in that world have no effect on that whatsoever, right? It's very different in the economy. Because you are part of it. You constitute it. Your beliefs about it make it happen. So if we think about the current AI bubble, yes, it's a bubble, because we've seen this many times before, is why is everybody piling money into it? Because everyone else is piling money into it. And because everyone else is piling money into it, there's a quantitative effect and the price is going up and you get FOMO and you don't want to be the one firm that misses out on it. So you pile your money into it and ultimately you're going to have valuations that are unsustainable and it's going to come down.
Yeah, it's kind of like that idea. I'm bullish, and then somebody else says, well, I'm also bullish, and then, whoa, suddenly we somehow happen to all be correct.
Exactly. <That's> so it's one of these things you'll often hear markets people say there's no such thing as dumb money or money on the side, because for everybody buying something, there has to be somebody else selling or something. And that's kind of true, but I don't also have to invest, but I also do have to invest if everyone else is investing. So all these dynamics go on at the same time.
So one of the biggest economic ideas, which well, I wouldn't say biggest, I'd say most fundamental, is of the rationally self-interested individual. So like a classic example is you go to a shop, there's a more expensive block of butter and a less expensive block of butter, same quality, you're going to buy the less expensive block of butter. That works most of the time.
Unless you go to Whole Foods, then basically yeah, exactly. You buy stupidly expensive butter for no reason.
And then they're all expensive.
Totally.
Yeah, but they have nice packaging and so on and so forth, and their raw milk and everything. So, you know, maybe it's worth it. But, you know, your sort of insight is that actually the belief that we're rationally self-interested, so to speak, mm-hmm. is what makes us act in maybe that selfish way. What's yeah, another example absolutely. Of a way like an economic belief, for example, concretely impacts our behavior in a way that people tend to naturalize and think is just part of the way that we interact?
God, so many things. I mean, I'll do an experiment with you guys right now, right? Lucas, what's your sale price?
My sale price?
Yeah, how much does it cost to rent you for a year?
As well, my wage wouldn't it be that yeah, way. Pretty much my wage.
But when I phrase it that way, I suddenly made it weird, right?
Yeah.
But this is literally what it is. It's the price exactly. to rent you for a year, right? And the terms and conditions under which we do this. For most of human history, people didn't have a price on their head and didn't sell themselves for years at time to particular things called employers. We had to invent all that shit and make it totally normal. Sociologists have a great story about this one, which is the invention of the clock. So if you go up north in England and you go into places in Scotland, you'll find that you go to the town square. One of the things that like dominates the town square in many places is the clock, because nobody else had a watch, right? Now, if you want people to work 8 hours a day, you kind of have to have a clock somewhere you can all refer to. But until you build the clock, it's really hard to reinforce an 8-hour day. So literally the action of building the clock makes it possible to run the factory. So, you know, all of this kind of, if you will, social architecture has to be built for us to actually behave as market creatures.
Clocking in, clocking out, right? That's the idea.
Clocking in, clocking out. Exactly. We're so used to it now. We actually use that as a phrase, but it actually refers to referring to that clock that somebody had to put there.
Yeah, it's interesting how the more precise we've been able to get with time, the more finely divided our time, let's say, for example, at work has been. So maybe an 8-hour day when all you had was the town hall clock would be, you know, to the nearest half an hour or something like that.
Right. So no, I was going to say, no, one of the things, it's quite a funny story, what happened with this is, of course, the employers would get, it used to be a 10-hour day or a 12-hour day, and the employers would get everybody in and lock the gates and then change the clock back, right? And one of the things that unions did was they got their own clocks. So you could argue about what the real time actually was, right? So yeah, I mean, we fight over time, absolutely.
Yeah, the example that jumps out to me is the controversy around Amazon tracking how much time people are spending on the toilet and stuff like that.
Right.
That's taken as quite normal now. You know, the way that we finally divide time, even when we're meeting friends, for example, we'll be like, oh, I'm seeing you at 8. And then when it's like 8:04, you're beginning to think by the time it's 8:05.
You get a bit antsy. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Because the phone has done this to you. When you meet your friend, this is being an old person, right? The one thing that I notice when I go out and I hang out in pubs and all the rest of it, I'm sitting there, is you see people who are obviously out on dates and one of them's on the phone not talking to the other one.
That's so bad. I see it all the time.
Yeah, you see it all the time because in a sense, that's not even rude, right? That's been naturalized because what you do is you multitask your friendships given the time constraints.
Hmm.
Right? Yeah. So we've naturalized that as well.
Yeah. And, you know, I think you refer to capitalism, right, as a commodification of everything. Well, that's your view of it. So this is, in some sense, what we're discussing, the commodification of time.
Yeah.
I don't know to what extent you'd agree with that statement.
So that phrase originally comes from Carl Pagliani, and some people are real sort of Carl Pagliani nuts. I'm kind of like Carl Pagliani adjacent. I like the way of thinking about it this way, because in a way, what we have done is commodified everything, right? If you think about things like the way the financial markets think about how can financial markets help decarbonization, well, we can turn this rainforest into a series of contracts, and then we can sell it, and then what we'll do is optimize it and do a carbon tax, right? There are other ways of doing things, but why is it we reach for that as the first thing? Why is it a natural instinct to turn everything a commodity, right? And the platform economy is a great example of this, right? So people used to have cars. They drove their own cars. Then they realized that they could basically, in a sense, commodify their own car, right? And that's what you do. Airbnb is commodifying not your own house, usually another one you bought. But if you're in an area like London, you can sell a room. So you're commodifying part of the space you live in. I mean, we do this to everything. And to a certain extent, it creates options. And that's good. But to another thing, what it does is reduces all our interactions to commodified interactions.
Yeah, what's interesting to me in that case is the way that economics kind of acts as a counterpart to that and rationalizes that sort of process of the commodification of everything. And it's treated like an objective science, right? Because, for example, Airbnb as a process of commodifying apartments is justified by the fact that, you know, according to economic calculations, it brings greater value. You're able to make something out of that. But of course, value is something that you can't really put a number on. How do we step away from...
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
No, go ahead. Finish the thought.
Yeah, I was going to say, how do we step away from treating value as something like a number, yet still being able to calculate in the way that we do in economics? How do we find that balance?
Well, you see, this goes back to a whole sort of schism that happens in economics in the 1870s. So what happened was old economists, the old school guys, your Adam Smiths, et cetera, right? And also up to including Marx, were all value theorists. And value was thought to inhere in labor. And therefore, the value of a commodity was how much effort was put into it, plus the inputs, et cetera, et cetera. And that was one way of calculating this stuff. Then along came like a couple of guys from Oxford and a bunch of Germans. And they basically said, no, what really matters is like what people get out of this. It's not the value of water. It's the value of water in a desert when you're dying, right? So how much are you willing to pay for that marginal glass of water given those conditions? So we started to do what's called marginal analysis, right? And when you do that, all questions of value evaporate, right? So think of the following. Do you guys like whiskey?
Wow.
Or are you too young for that? You're probably too young.
Maybe like a Jack and Coke. I don't know.
Right. Okay.
It's a bit of a...
Well, see, when you get...
At least young age.
So like, when you're old and you get rich, particularly, which is not me, but some people, right? They'll collect things like really expensive whiskeys and really expensive wine and all the rest of it, right? Is there any real difference in any of this shit? Like why does like a Pappy Van Winkle cost $2,000 or whatever like that? Because other rich idiots think it costs that. And basically it is. The marginalist story is true in the sense that they're willing to pay for that. In some sense, they get utility out of this. Maybe they hold it and then they sell it for $4,000 or whatever. But it's got bugger all to do with the intrinsic value, right? Now, think again about like London housing. Why do we value housing? So we don't die of exposure. Why is London housing so goddamn expensive? Because we forgot to build enough for the past 40 years. That's a good way of starting with it. So I can give you a value explanation, right? There's not enough housing. But I can also go, yeah, but then we basically gave everybody the right to turn their house into an ATM. And then some areas became super desirable. And then some people got better mortgages. And then everybody decided that housing was an asset. So you buy it because you know you're going to sell it in 5 years and do something else. You take the money out and all. So we commodified our housing. So in a sense, the sort of the value question, which is what we're coming back to in many ways, we do all this sort of stuff. Where's the value in it? That's a question that lies outside the market. It's a question to do with community. It's a question to do with how we think of each other as citizens, as members of a society, and what do we value? Whereas everything in economics is an individual calculation about the utility that you get from this action. They're very, very different.
Yeah, it reminds me of the tulip mania. And you can probably elaborate on this, and you probably know a lot more about it than I do. From my understanding, it was in the 1800s in the Netherlands, there was this huge craze about these really particular kind of flowers. And, you know, the only reason people value them was because other people value them. But at the end of the day, they were just a flower. And then at one point, everyone just looked at these flowers and said, why am I paying so much for a flower?
That is more or less it, right?
Well, it's like every economic bubble ever, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like, no, why are you paying this for AI? I mean, the entire AI project is really interesting in a way because it's very Marxist. Marxists used to have this belief that enough of a quantitative effect leads to a quality of change, right? I won't bore you to death with why, right? But essentially, that's the AI stack idea, that if we just add more and more chips, one day the stack will wake up and go, good morning, Dave, and it will be conscious. And whoever gets that rules the world. And you're like, are you guys fucking high? Do you really think that's going to happen? And the answer is maybe, but they're doing it because everybody else is trying it, because if they get HAL, the supercomputer, and you don't, you die, right? So there's a way in which the bubble's rational to be in, even though it's collectively irrational as a society for us to invest in this shit.
Yeah, it's a collective action problem, right?
Yeah, totally. Exactly. Well, the particular form of it, collective action problems, usually when you're trying to get people to do something, they won't do it because they're waiting for somebody else to do it. This is kind of actually a collective gains type problem, whereas there's gains to be made. And unless I'm in the game, I can't take part in the gains. And so long as everybody takes part in the gains, there are gains. But eventually the gains hit a ceiling, right? There's a barrier and that's it. So you might call it a Ponzi scheme if you want to think about it that way.
Well, as an economist yourself, how do we get out of that? Or what does someone like Microsoft or Google, what do they do if not keep investing? If that's where the money is, isn't that where they should go to some extent?
So here's an interesting critique of capitalism, right? The main reason that we allow the private sector to make investment decisions is because we used to have very broad economies. And what I mean by that was not 40% of everything wasn't in five firms, right? This is a very unusual situation. And people would invest in tennis courts and people would make the tennis rackets and somebody would make the AstroTurf and somebody make the netting and so on and so forth. And we don't make any of that shit. We just import it from China. And what you have on the other side of this is like we do tech in a bunch of absolutely massive firms that are all making one concentrated bet on one thing. Well, the whole point of giving the private sector the right to do investment is you're meant to make loads and loads of different things. Some of them will be totally stupid and fail. And across thousands of people, the millions of people doing this, some really amazing shit will pop up and then we'll follow that. And that's better than the central planner and the government. Well, what we've now got is the central planner and the private sector, and it's called five dudes. And they're all obsessed with AI.
Well, yeah, the term capitalism, right, is almost a bit too broad of a category. I mean, when you look at like the sort of market economies that we had in, say, like the late 18th century, where you're describing exactly, there were obviously big firms and big private interests and inequality, but they weren't so dominating. Now yeah. They are highly dominating.
On a global scale, very much on a global scale. Like we're using American tech right now. I'm sitting in America, you're not. We're all using American tech. You've got a Shure mic in front of you, same as I do. We're using Riverside as a platform. This is probably sitting in an Amazon cloud server somewhere, right? The whole probably. Thing is just stacked. Right.
Yeah. So how do we move away from that? I mean, there's just so much concentrated economic power, which ultimately means political power.
Yes.
How can we reduce the power or make it significantly less concentrated? What sort of paths are there available to us to shift the form of capitalism that we're in?
So I think that there's a whole bunch of this is going on in contemporary populism. Yes, it gets pushed into a right-wing corner. Yes, it's about immigration and so on and so forth. But it's also about more than that. It is about this profound feeling that things are sort of like at the wrong scale. That we vote nationally, yet economic decisions seem to happen globally. The anti-globalism in these movements is something that like 40 years ago would have been regarded as a kind of a left-wing phenomena rather than a right-wing phenomena. So I think that there's lots of reactions that are around, you know, looking at this. There's also a lot of misdirection by the people who are making out like bandits like this, basically the broligarch class, if you want to call them that, who control the social media that basically push you down a channel of don't look at us making billions and possibly blowing up the economy. Look down there at those people in those small boats, even though there's 200 of them. That's your crisis, right? So there's a lot of misdirection that goes on with this as well. How do we usually change these systems? When you get super concentrated political and economic power, they tend to be very fragile systems. There's no redundancies. There's no alternatives. Basically, they're very fragile. And that means a shock comes along, maybe the AI bubble pops, these firms lose a shit ton of money, one or two of them disappears. And traditionally what would happen is the government would come in and say, right, you lot, you're not doing that again. And what was so instructive about the 2008 financial crisis, is what all that happened and the government came in and said, right, you lot, let me bail you out. Nobody goes to jail. Why don't we try it again? And that's a part of what pissed everyone off. Because there was no reset, right? Because otherwise what you have is at the end of the day, you end up with capitalism where basically all of the risk is socialized by the public and all the rewards are taken by a handful of private actors. Because if you blow up, if the AI bubble blows up tomorrow, I'll bet you $10 to a dollar, the Federal Reserve will jump in and basically put a floor under the equity prices of these companies because they're too big to fail, just like banks. So they get to basically blow the world up. Then they get an insurance policy to call on. And that's ultimately everybody else's money.
Ultimately, if the big dogs fail, right, they can just liquidate their assets, so on and so forth. But if the economy is doing shit, the average person will suffer either way. They're the ones that can't put food on their plates.
That's it.
It's, I think, to some extent, this is trickle-down economics that people are relying on. It's the idea that if the top dogs are doing really well, everyone else will do well. My understanding is that you don't agree with that concept.
Well, I mean, there's no empirical evidence for it. I mean, we started off by talking about, you know, being corrigible to facts. I encourage everybody on this pod to go find the following document from the RAND Corporation, right, which is a sort of like center-right think tank spun off from the military in the 50s, based in California, not exactly whining lefties. And they've got this document called the Trends in Income 1980 to 2010 or something like this. You'll find it. And basically, it's this exercise where they say, all right, so imagine we stopped time in 1980. And then we basically didn't do any of the things that we did to taxes, regulation, anything like that, bank system. We just kept it all the same. And we ran the economy forward. What would happen? Your average American would be $16,000 a year better off. There would be no billionaires, right? What happened was $36 trillion, with a T, went up in the form of tax cuts, in the form of appreciation of share prices, in the form of dividends, etc. And practically nothing came down, which is why the bottom two-thirds of the income distribution of the US, with one or two years as exceptions in the recent past, haven't had any sustained real income gains in over 30 years. Corporate profits are in this country are now 12.5% of GDP. Historically, they're 6 to 8%. The labor share of GDP is lower than it's been since the 1940s, I think, because its peak was in 73 and it's basically reversed. So like 11 percentage points of GDP have gone to 5% of the population and everybody else has 11 points less. I mean, these are just facts. There's nothing to do with the politics of how you interpret it, whatever. It's simply the fact. So if you start there, yeah, trickle down's done nothing. It's all sucked up.
And yet people still believe in it, right? I so often see the argument, for example, that by taxing huge corporations or by implementing taxes on billionaires or even just very high net worth individuals, we're going to scare them away. They'll go to another country or whatever. Another example is austerity. There's so many economic ideas which don't have the empirical evidence supporting them. And yet, by and large, the public tend to believe them, or at least large swathes do. Why is that?
So the austerity one's really interesting. I haven't written about it, right? But I've got colleagues at UCL that do kind of experiments on people, not the ones you do in a dungeon with a cleaver, more the ones you do with a survey or something like this, right? And what they did was, and it's less fun, but more science, right? So anyway, what they did was they basically set people up to do kind of their attitudes towards austerity, right? And what they found in Britain in particular is that people understand that if the government spends money, right, and they'll get this right the way they did this now, they understand that if the government runs a deficit, there might be some taxes in the future they might have to pay for the deficit. That doesn't really trouble them, right? What they don't like it when government spends, particularly if the economy is going down, because then they feel that in some sense, you know, they'll have to pay for it, right? But what they really don't see is the following, which is when you cut taxes, you increase the deficit. Right. And that is exactly the same as like running a deficit when the shit hits the fan. So you get this kind of asymmetric reaction, which means that anybody who comes along and says, well, now's the time to tighten our belts and maybe cut some taxes, regardless of the consequences, they win. Somebody else comes along and says, we're really in the shitter. This is going to get really bad unless we put a floor underneath this. They tend to lose. So there's kind of like, you know, asymmetric reasoning, you know, basically the heuristics we use to think about things might go some way into that. But let me talk for a minute about this whole thing about billionaires and tax cuts, right? Billionaires don't have any income. I mean, I'm literally, I don't understand the tax cuts in the United States, because once you get to about 50 million or above, if you've got a decent accountant, you don't have income. What you do is, like, the way Jeff Bezos actually gets money is he takes a bunch of Amazon shares and takes them to a lender as collateral and says, I'll give you 200 million of Amazon shares. Based on that, can you give me 10 million in cash to spend? And they go, yeah, absolutely. You're a pretty safe bet. If I hold on to these shares and you don't pay me the money back, they'll be worth more. That's even better, right? But you will pay me back and you've got zero credit risk. So how about 2% for the loan? And Jeff goes, that'll be great. So Jeff got 10 million to spend and his effective tax rate's 2%, because you don't pay taxes on loan income. Nobody rich has actual income. So this whole thing that we're like, oh, if you cut the taxes on, if you put the taxes on really rich people, they don't have any income. This is just bullshit to start with, right?
But you could target the tax that way, right? If you were aware.
Right. If you actually had income, you could just go get it. But it's real. Why are people talking about a wealth tax? Because they don't have any income. Right? It's that simple, right? As for the argument that they don't move, I mean, Jesus, there's so much research on this. Like, they don't move. Even the non-dom stuff, I've got a little link in the Financial Times. You can gather articles, and it's all about the non-doms and basically are they leaving and they're not leaving, whatever. Every week it changes. Yes, they're definitely leaving. The next week, no, they're not leaving. Now, why are you not leaving? Because you're a billionaire. Like most billionaires, you dump your first wife. You've now got your second wife, the model, right? She's fitting in really well in Chelsea with her friends over the past 5 years. You've got a new kid other than your old family. So they're now at this snotty little school in Chelsea. And the tax rate goes up. And you go, honey, we have to move now. Because even though it's a tiny part of my income, which I don't have, we have to move because I'm so sensitive to tax rates. So pull young wanker out of school and dump your friends. We're off and we're going to go live in Abu Dhabi, right?
Well, then your wife or husband's not going to find it very convincing, are they?
Exactly.
We're going to have 99 billion instead of 100.
Yeah, his stuff is out the window by that night, right? Everybody knows this. Like, people don't move. Like, honestly, you look at mobility statistics across the developed countries, the United States is meant to be the most mobile society, right? By the time everyone's 40, nobody moves. There's a slight uptick when they get to 65 if they want to go to Florida because they like the sun and they don't want to pay state income taxes. And that's a tiny fraction of the population, right? So they don't move, they don't earn income. I mean, everything that we think about this, that governments talk about, it's like mainly bullshit.
What about wealth tax, though? Let's say you do increase wealth tax significantly. There are, right, anecdotally, there are people that move country because the taxes are too high.
Yeah.
So if you increase wealth tax, let's say 10, 15%, and you lose even 1-2 billionaires, that is a quite significant effect on, let's say, the British economy. Or would you disagree?
Is it? Because ultimately, what really counts in power and economy is demand. And if you're like a normal punter, you spend 80% of your money getting by, which means you put a lot into consumption spending. Every other punter like you does the same, and that's what powers everything. And you're a billionaire. What do? How many sub-zero fridges do you need in a week? Right, you don't actually spend that much. Oh, but these are the investors, right? Are they investing in your country? I mean, is that the case? Because a lot of the ones that we had from India had all of their assets in India, lived here tax-free, and basically didn't invest in the United Kingdom. So if they leave, what's the net loss, right? So this notion that investment comes from fantastically rich people rather than public markets, existing corporations, like actual investment in your own country that goes on every single day, public investment. I mean, this is just another layer of bullshit that's like basically allows the situation to continue.
And also, correct me if I'm wrong, but let's say you get a 10% increase on your income as like a middling income person, let's say a mean average in the UK. Your propensity to spend increases massively, and you're going to be injecting that into the economy because that makes a huge difference, right? If you're struggling to put food on the table and all of a sudden you have 10% more income, you're definitely using it, and so on and 100%. So forth. But actually, for a billionaire, going from 10 billion to 11 billion, I mean, you're not going to be injecting that much more, right? So the wealth increase is actually significantly less productive for the economy because it doesn't get it in circulation, right?
A great example of this is the guy who's running for mayor in New York had a funny one yesterday. There's a billionaire called Steve Schwarzman who's spending literally billions like on adverts and saying that this guy is Stalin and all the rest of it. And the other day he said, you know, if I were to tax him, I'd tax him less than he's spending to trash me. And there's a really profound insight in this, which is when we are doing Econ 101, we talk about the declining marginal value of money. So let's go back to your example. You're a single mom, you got two jobs, you get a £10 increase, you're going to spend the whole 10 quid, right? You're Lucas, right? You're young, you're handsome, you're going places, you're above middle income. It's all fantastic, right?
What I mean.
Let's say that he gets 10 quid. I'll get to you in a minute. Like, you're even,
oh, okay.
I say, don't worry about that, you're fine. So anyway, you know, he gets the 10 quid, right? He maybe spends 8, saves 2, right? You have been playing crypto. You've got more money than you can count. I give you £1,000, you don't even notice, right? Why then is it when we get to the billionaire class that the very idea of taxing them produces this reaction? Don't you tax me! Right? What happened? Like, you've got so much money that you would never even notice if I took a bit of it. But you see, even the word to them, they lose their shit completely. It's more of a sociological thing.
Mm. So how can we inject sociological analysis into economics in a healthy way? Because, you know, one of your big problems with economics is that it's treated as like this hard science. Oh, look at how much more value can be created. Look at how much GDP will increase without looking at what that actually means concretely for people. But, you know, once you start adding so much detail from other social sciences,
yeah,
maybe it becomes like a lot more confusing what conclusions we're supposed to be drawing. So how do we integrate economics, which is ultimately primarily statistical, with these other considerations, which are partially moral and partially social scientific in other more nuanced ways?
Right. Well, I would say by, you know, in a sense, confining the analysis to where it works. I mean, it's not that I'm sort of anti-econ. I'm actually a fan. It's just that I think that it's been too widely spread. And for a certain point in time, it became almost a religion. And it shouldn't be. I mean, it is simultaneously a way of looking at the world that produces, I think, sometimes pretty profound insights. And also an engine that drives the world. If you're the people who get to say uniquely what the word deficiency means, how to implement it, and why that's a better goal than equality, or why that's a better goal than sort of, I don't know, fairness in some description, then, you know, you get to set society on a certain path. And I think during the 80s and 90s in particular, we went down that path. A lot of people made out like bandits, and a whole lot more people really didn't. And we're now dealing with the consequences of this. How do we deal with this? This is the realm of politics. But part of the problem was we convinced our political classes, and forgive, you guys both went to Oxford, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. So I call this the PPE problem, right? You basically, you know, just enough to basically be dangerous. So you do, you know a little bit about politics, you know a little bit about economics, you know, I'm not deriding the individuals, it's the nature of the course. And you tell me if this is right or not, right? You were taught that central banking, it's independent central banks are good.
Well, right. I did philosophy in French, so unfortunately I'm not knowledgeable as you think I might be, but let's assume I was a knowledgeable PPE student. Let's just assume.
So there was a certain consensus, right, at least until about 2008, maybe even longer, about the way the world worked, and it was very much markets are all good, politicians have what are called inconsistent preferences. They'll say one thing and then vote for another, and that produces inflation, so we need to have these central banks and blah, 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 and this is the way the world works. And it's not really how the world works at all, and we're beginning to grapple with this now. But what it did was it made for a generation of shit politicians. Because if you tell them that basically the central bankers have got this, markets are efficient, finance is great, what do you actually do in Parliament? And the answer through the 2000s was less and less. And you sit around and tweet about minority issues, and you get obsessed with little things that don't really matter. And you engage in a politics of division and distraction, and you don't actually address questions. The whole point of our parliament, the whole point is to tackle the hard questions. Not just in the Labour's case, I get fucking enraged by this. Oh, we've got fiscal rules. Okay, that's great. Who's in charge then? You are the rules. Right? What you got a whopping great majority. What's it for? Well, you know, the adults are in charge now. So what does that mean? So like, are you going to do anything that makes a difference in the life of ordinary Brits or not? Because it would just tell us what it is, right? And it's led to this astonishing, either in the terms of the Conservatives, just self-destructive bullshit like Brexit. In the case of Labour, they're too afraid of their own fiscal shadow to do anything. And so your answer is not about integrating sociology into economics. It's having a politics in the political class that has the courage to actually tackle the questions that they're being elected to tackle.
Yeah, Slavoj Žižek has this concept of the post-political, and he says that basically we're in like a post-political age, right? And what he means by that is that there's such a huge consensus on the big issues, like the ones you've described about finance, markets, and so on and so forth, that we end up talking about these really, you know, things which are important in their own right, but shouldn't dominate conversation, like particular social questions.
Yeah, absolutely. No, absolutely. The whole identity politics thing. Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly.
Like, how did we become obsessed with what I call neoliberal rights of the person? Mm. Right? I mean, in many cases, these were sort of settled questions. In many cases, they weren't. Groups were oppressed, etc., all the rest of it. But that's what we became solely concerned about, that, as if all the other questions went off the table. Now, the thing about the anti-political move is it always invites a politics, right? You cannot expel politics, because when our conception of what we should be doing, I'll be a philosopher for a minute, our ends of life, right? The Kantian project, if you want to put it that way, right? When we no longer agree on those ends, you cannot pretend we're in an anti-political moment. Politics comes running back in. And what we see now in the populist moment is very much that moment, where basically people have said, don't tell me everything's okay and you guys have got this and you know how it all works. Because from what I said, you don't. And there are millions of people who think the same way. And that's why the politics comes back in. It's always there.
Yeah, it's interesting. The idea of economics being able to tell you the real situation is debatable. Ollie and I were preparing a lot for our recent interview with George Finch and trying to understand to what extent immigration has been affecting the British economy. The results, the studies are actually wildly differing. It's hard to actually come to the quote-unquote truth.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, if we were able to ascertain that immigration is 100% net benefit to the UK, then to some extent you've got your answer. And that's what maybe economists try to draw on. I don't know what your opinion is on maybe that specific issue, but more widely, the ways in which economics and truth are related.
So to get to the latter one, let's talk about the former one, right? Because I don't shy away from discussions about immigration. Here's how I think about it. You start with a very simple model of the economy. It's a number of physical people, humans. It's the number of hours they're willing to work or able to work, and the quality and quantity of stuff that they do things with. That's it. It's nothing more than that. Now, just think about this for a minute. If you don't have enough kids, you drop below the replacement rate of 2.1, then basically you either have to work more hours or you have to employ more capital. The only other way out of that, and both of those are actually hard and nobody wants to work any more hours, and when you have a big service sector economy, it's not clear what capital you add to a hairdresser to make them more efficient, right? So what do? You need more people. The European Union project was basically sort of like quasi-safe immigration for that problem of declining birth rates. Now, that sounds very technocratic. It doesn't care about cultures. It doesn't care about peoples. Absolutely, but it's true. Here's someone else who's true. If you basically give everybody who wants to show up to a British university and pay full fees a visa, and they get to bring their family and mates with them, and they all go into big cities, and you've already got a housing shortage, do you think that's going to fuck up rents? Yeah, it is, absolutely. And being blind to that just strikes me as being absolutely stupid. So yes, of course, there are externalities, as they call it in the language, to immigration. Some of them are positive, some of them can be positive, some of them can be extremely negative. I mean, there's a bit of a myth here that's sort of like, well, we were always okay with immigration until, for example, Farage showed up. And you're like, are you kidding me? They used to have signs and windows in London that would say no Scots for renting a room. No Irish. The famous one that's on an album, I forget whose album it is. No dogs in Irish. The dogs came first. Right? Yeah. Immigration has never been popular. We had this moment in the 1990s where it seemed that that was no longer a thing, but it's now back to where it was before, and this has always been contentious politics. One of the biggest screw-ups of the democratic left throughout the West is just this thing whereby, no, it's always been fine, and anyone who says otherwise is a racist. You're like, are you kidding me? This has never been true.
I remember learning one really shocking thing about like our attitudes to immigration in the past, especially since it was like comparatively so recent, was a campaign. I think it was during a by-election, but it was a campaign by the Conservative Party when Churchill was at the head. So it was effectively directing the messaging for the Conservative Party, right? This is in 1951. In big letters, it was just "Keep Britain White." That seems
exactly right.
That seems really recent to have such like,
yeah, totally,
basically racist discourse. Right.
Now, the interesting thing is the consensus that evolved around this in the 60s, the guys who do, what's it called, Origin Story podcast, right? They have a really good episode on Enoch Powell. And one of the things that comes across in this was, A, the fact that Powell was just using these arguments instrumentally to basically position himself high up in the Tory party. But the other thing was, when you surveyed Brits at the time, you wouldn't believe the percentage of people who thought he was right. And we're talking 70 or 80% agreed with him. What was remarkable was that there was a cross-party consensus that if we go down the road, you get the rivers of blood, let's not go there, right? What's happened now is that has completely broken down. Nobody is able to do that policing work anymore.
Yeah, I think the main problem, though, right, is not that we are discussing immigration as a whole. It's the fact that it's being used as a placeholder, basically, right? You know, the hammer which can hit any nail, i.e. the thing which can solve any problem, let's stop immigration. I feel like the problem isn't really so much that it's always been contentious, and so therefore we're obviously discussing it now. But we have seen a super radical shift towards anti-immigration discourse.
We've also seen some of the highest immigration numbers in 50 years. I mean, there's a reason.
Is that the primary cause in your mind?
The primary cause,
I have a different hypothesis, but I'd be interested to hear.
No, I'd be interested in yours. No, I mean, basically, if you have high volumes of people arriving who are culturally different, who then arrive in places that are unbelievably expensive, where the people who are already there are struggling to make ends meet and have housing, if that doesn't turn into an anti-immigration politics, I would be extraordinarily surprised why. Of course, whether it's done instrumentally or whether it's because you actually feel the displacement effects, that's going to happen. The fact that people are shocked by it is the shock. What's yours?
Well, look, I'm not going to say that that has no impact, right? Usually the answers that are more likely to be correct are the more complex ones. But, you know, you yourself said earlier in the podcast that when you have so much power concentrated in the hands of a certain number of billionaires, especially when they have control over things like messaging, the news, so on and so forth. Basically,
Musk is weaponizing this, totally. Yeah,
exactly. Most of that, right, in my opinion, despite the fact that, of course, immigration has massively increased, is the fact that basically it's being pushed as an issue a lot more. And that's because there are certain things that the people who, you know, control where we get our news from would rather that was what was being talked about, right?
Yeah.
How do you think those two interact in terms of importance for the resurgence?
They're not orthogonal. They don't cancel each other out. They can be simultaneously true. Let me ask you a question, right? If you lived in a place like Dundee or Bolton or someplace like this, right? You know, Bradford, take your pick, right? What about the phenomena whereby you're getting older, all the younger people are ethnically different from you? And what happens now is the pubs close down and you get sweet shops. Now, as far as an economist is concerned, we don't give a shit. They're both businesses. They're both employing people. People are happy because it's probably healthier that they're having sweets rather than having alcohol, so knock yourself out. But you know culturally that this is going to be a problem, right? You know that people are going to feel resentment towards this, that their way of life is passing, that youth is basically something that's different from them that they find hard to understand, that they resent on some level. So it's not as if it's just pure manipulation or there's a simple functional effect. You have to join the dots. And politics is about how you join the dots either very badly or you join it very well and you make it into a net positive. What's really interesting and also quite disturbing is that countries that traditionally had an incredibly tolerant attitude towards immigration, think of Ireland, for example, right? I mean, Ireland had this, basically because it was such a net immigration country, like Ireland's left in drove, that when they started to get rich in the 1990s, they had this cross-party consensus, cross-societal consensus that we're going to be okay with immigration. A very hell of it. Now you've got basically an immigration riots, right?
Right. Yes, Canada, yesterday, I think, as well.
Yeah. Canada was the same. Australia was the same. Now, why are all these people kicking off? Are they being manipulated? Absolutely. But you've got to have something that they're uncomfortable with.
Yeah, I think that, to be honest, I'd probably position myself somewhere between the two of you. The idea that governments will tell the people where we need this amount of immigration for the economy is somewhat true, and I'd like to hear your opinion on that as well, because a suffering economy, getting more people in will help, especially, like, say, the NHS, for example. It's crucial.
Very simple. Paying taxes. Look, if you and your white granny are getting old, you're going to be on a pension at some point. For that pension to be made is a credible promise, because everyone's living longer with more complex diseases, hence why the NHS costs a bloody fortune. You simply need more taxpayers. And if you haven't had enough kids yourself, then you have to import them. And if you don't, your NHS and your pensions collapse. It's a simple choice.
It's an issue of, like, falling birth rates as well. I think that's a huge issue. And that's maybe partly to do with individualist societies and, you know, people more interested in their careers, which, you know, to some extent also contribute to the economy. But what I'm trying to get at is there is that cultural issue with huge increases in immigration rates. And I think it's personally, I think it's to do with the rates of immigration.
Yeah.
I think
it happens rather than, yeah.
Because, I mean, if you look at Windrush generation or, you know, slower periods of immigration in the 1900s, I think there was more time for assimilation to occur, cultural assimilation. And mm-hmm. I think with falling birth rates in Europe, paired with extremely high growth rates post-COVID of, increased rates of immigration post-COVID,
mm-hmm.
a cultural clash has manifested in terms of how people view immigration now. That seems to be my...
But let me add something on to this, though. What I find peculiar about the sort of the peak neoliberal period was that, in a sense, we all became deracinated. We were all, if we were doing well, global subjects. We were all, to put it in the language of Theresa May, I never thought I'd quote her, citizens of nowhere, right? Mm. And that was to be applauded. We were post-racial, et cetera, et cetera. Now, this is all fine if you have a conception of society where everyone's completely comfortable by being deracinated, right? There are no Scots, there are no English. I mean, you know, go to a football match and tell me that's true. Now, let's say that, you know, that works for a while, but then things begin to suck, like the British economy since 2008. Resources are more scarce, etc. And then you have not just high waves of immigration or increasing the rate of immigration. You have a lot of cultural heterogeneity in who's coming in. I mean, it's everybody from everywhere, right? And it's no longer clear what you're meant to assimilate to. And when you've got groups that are individually big enough to maintain their own culture, and it's really not clear what you're meant to actually assimilate to, then you get, you know, in a good sense, a mosaic. But in a bad sense, you've got a balkanized society. And, you know, people, whether, and if you see the mosaic or you see the Balkans, very much depends upon your overall attitude towards immigration, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, I think these are real things. We used to have a conception of citizenship, that with rights came responsibilities, that this was bound by a nation, that at one point we had conceptions of like national service. God, imagine that, right? And we weren't just like just a bunch of consumers who happened to share the same passport. And when you basically do that and also seriously forget that anyone outside of London actually has a voice, and the fact that their lives are becoming shittier while yours is better is probably a problem. And then you throw lots of different people into the mix. I'm only surprised that people are surprised.
Yeah. I mean, to some extent, I do think there is too much emphasis placed on the immigration issue. And I think it is, like Ollie said, something that's been manipulated in the media. I think the effect on economy is overblown. And I think,
yeah,
to a large effect, we need immigration. And I know that you agree with this as well. Of course, it's a more nuanced truth. And I feel like we've come at least somewhat close to that in this discussion. Do you have any kind of closing thoughts, maybe not just about immigration, but about the conversation we had in general today?
Well, I mean, you know, we dived into the immigration one because, you know, I think that people, you know, shy away from it. And I think the best thing to do with anything that's contentious is like bring it out in the open and try and figure it out. And, you know, and don't be tight to be right about it. I mean, think about what is this? How could it be understood? Why does it have these sort of reactions? And, you know, take it back to the start, you know, the issue of you learning from being wrong. If I've said anything about immigration that people find contentious or wrong or insulting or whatever, I'm sorry on one level. But if we don't talk to each other about these things, how do we ever expect to make any progress on it? Right, so to bring it all back to the start, in a sense, we only actually get smart by having an argument, and an argument where we take each other seriously and respectfully. And a lot of what's been lost and a lot of what's been weaponized, and Ollie's exactly right on this, is basically our ability to listen to each other, to accept that we can be wrong, and to learn from each other.
For sure. And that's why the ethos of the podcast is to learn how to think, not what exactly to think. But Mark, we've really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you for coming on.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
This has been Critical Edge, signing off.